Welcome to The Created Life. Each week, The Created Life podcast offers insightful, inspiring interviews with entrepreneurs, creatives, and people just like you about being empowered, living with vitality, and creating positive change in the world through creative action. The Created Life covers a wide range of topics relating to personal growth, adventure, inspiration, business, social impact, fitness, and health. My name is Damian Taggart. I'm a serial social impact entrepreneur, and I'll be your host on this journey. Thanks for joining me for this episode of The Created Life. In this week's installment of The Created Life, Vince Kedlubek and I dive into his personal story of overcoming a troubled past before founding the wildly successful immersive arts company, Meow Wolf. Vince talks about his struggle coming to terms with his sexuality, his run-in with the law, and his personal life prior to finding his stride as an entrepreneur. Vince reveals what he is most proud of and what pursuing a life of creativity means to him. We discuss business, his vision for himself, embracing the unknown, and his business advice for would-be entrepreneurs and visionaries. Enjoy the show. All right, welcome to the Created Life podcast. I am here with CEO of Meow Wolf, Vince Kedlubek. Thanks so much for being here, Vince.
Definitely, man. Thanks for having me.
It's going to be nice to chat. So for listeners who don't know who Meow Wolf is yet, do you want to kind of give just like a quick overview of kind of where the company's at and what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, we operate out of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and we're like an art production company. We produce these large-scale, immersive, sort of artistic storytelling experiences that we have one open here in Santa Fe called the House of Eternal Return, and it's basically like a walk-through psychedelic sci-fi novel. So it's inside of a 20,000-square-foot building. You go inside, you see a bunch of crazy colors and crazy rooms, and you kind of uncover a story through all of these like large sculptural immersive spaces. So it's been open for 3 years. It's super successful. And now, like, after we realized that the Santa Fe one was so successful, we like then started to think about expanding to other cities, and so it's just sort of like taken off from there. We're expanding into Denver and Vegas and Washington, D.C. and Phoenix, and it's been a wild ride. Like making the thing was crazy, and also then like next up, like operating the thing with all of its like people and success like was crazy, and then now like expanding and like building a company that can expand. It's all just been nuts.
Totally. And if you, for any listeners that want to get deeper into the backstory of Meow Wolf, there's actually a really great documentary that's out right now that I think they can download from the Meow Wolf site. Is that right?
Yeah. Meowwolf.com/doc.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. And that will give you all of the kind of backstory of how this small group of friends, like in their 20s, turned this, you know, basically project that was an on again, off again art collective into a multi-million-dollar business, and so it's a pretty interesting story, and you can learn more about that there, I think, is probably the best place. And you know, I wanted to kind of shift the focus of this interview a little bit to, you know, Meow Wolf is amazing, and it's a great achievement, and I think we will talk more about it, but.
You can Google that. You can talk about Meow Wolf.
Just like, I'm interested in, you know, sharing, getting some more of your story out. How did, you know, so I think some of the things that you've gone through could be really inspiring to people in terms of, you know, turning your life around from certain points, changing your perspective. Do you want to talk a little bit about, like, maybe some of the struggles you've had to overcome to get to where you are now, to get to your present success?
Yeah, I mean, there's been so many. I mean, it's like... It's hard to even know where to begin necessarily. Like I didn't go to college. I barely graduated high school. I literally like took a English test on the last day of my senior year, and my like teacher like graded it on the spot in order for me to then go run and take that test over to my my principal to show them that like I passed the test in order to get the grade to graduate the next day. Like I basically almost was a dropout and then like didn't go to college. And, you know, I grew up with like parents who were public school teachers. So we grew up very, you know, very poor. And honestly, like I felt quite like alienated, from the world, you know, mm-hmm. and like, I didn't really want to participate in the processes that were, kind of laid out there for me, school and like career and all that. And like, kind of like, you know, deep down, like, you know, at my core, I was struggling with my sexuality. I was, you know, closeted, a closeted gay kid. And that was tough.
In a small town, basically.
Yeah, right? In a small town. And like, you know, I think that has been something that has, you know, we've become more tolerant over the years, you know. And so I graduated in 2000, but, you know, it's like, it wasn't that, you know, accepted. And especially amongst the friends that I kind of hung out with, which was mostly like sports teams, jocks, basketball players, like, and so I just sort of like had always struggled with that. I also was like, I don't know, I probably have some amount of like, difficult psychological, you know, periods in my life, mm-hmm. especially in high school. And I don't exactly know where it stems from, but like it took a lot of work for me to like focus, to like tie my shoes, to like, mm-hmm. to like clean my car, to like take care of myself, to eat well. And it's been like so much work to like get my mind, which is like a crazy mind that goes in so many directions, to get it to like focus. And you know, the noise to signal ratio, getting like improving that ratio for myself. So yeah, I mean, things were tough. And like, I like, you know, out of high school, I ended up just, I lived here in Santa Fe and worked restaurant jobs, busser jobs, hated them, got fired all the time from my jobs, couldn't keep a job, couldn't pay rent, trashed my houses, like, you know, was really trying to like fill a void of like a social void in my life that I missed out on in high school because of my closeted and my angst. And so when I got out of high school, I started just like throwing kind of like ridiculous parties that were totally irresponsible and like trashed my houses, and then got like lawsuits, you know, filed against me because of it. And so I was sort of like on the run, it felt like. Mm-hmm. Like I was on the run from society, and I was on the run from my parents and my family. Ended up just like sort of living in my car for a good like 6 months of my life in my early 20s. And like, I don't know, it wasn't a very good track. I wasn't on a very good track.
Right.
And even when I fell back, even when I got sort of some of my shit together, I still like, still couldn't hold a job, like struggled to pay rent. I was a shoplifter. I like, you know, caught shoplifting multiple times, and like been to jail multiple times because of it. So it's just been a struggle, man. And like been like wanting so badly to have people like see my brilliance, but there's like such a large gap between like what I envisioned and what people saw.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it wasn't until this project, you know, mm-hmm. 4 years ago, 3 years ago when we opened the doors, like, you know, it wasn't until then that finally clicked for the first time, where people were like, oh shit, Vince is like, actually, you know, has a pretty amazing vision in his head. So it's like, I've been just like, struggling with that, you know?
Totally. Yeah, that's really interesting. I think like along the way, can you talk about like some of the things, like what were some of the either pivotal moments for you where like you know, something clicked where you're like, okay, the path that I'm on isn't working. I need to go. Like, was there something like that that happened? Was there some instances that you can point to that are like, this moment really shifted things for me? Or
there's been, I mean, of course there's been a series of, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, like, you know, I remember being like, I remember being like 20 years old and, you know, 20, 21 years old after my little bout of like living in my car and stuff. And like the car that I had was a car that my parents bought for me because I couldn't save enough money to even get a car. And I was trying so hard to kind of like get back on track in my life and got in a car wreck. And I remember like taking the car back to my parents then and just like falling apart and just being like, it just felt like I couldn't do anything right. You know what I mean? Like, it just mm-hmm. felt like I'm not, you know, the classic, like, I'm not meant for this world is what it felt like, you know? And there's just been a bunch of moments like that. Mm-hmm. The biggest pivotal moment for me, there's been a few of them, but like, we started Meow Wolf in 2008. A year later, I had left the group. We started in 2008 as like an art collective, just like a social club. And a year later, I left the group because I was like, I felt like my power was challenged by people close to me in the group, and I was having trouble with that. And so I left the group, and during that period of time, got quite, you know, suicidal and just held a grudge. You know, it's like I left Meow Wolf, but then I blamed them for me leaving. And I blamed my friends for me not talking to them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so it was like, it was their fault that I was, that I alienated myself. And I just held that grudge and it just ate me up inside. And ended up doing Landmark, the Landmark Forum, in 2009. And that completely like shifted everything for me. It, like, made me realize just how much of a grudge I was holding. It made me realize just like how much of a responsibility I had to my life and to my situation that I was in. You know, kind of like oriented me towards leadership. I was really self-conscious about leadership. Like, my leadership, I was like overly leadership, like follow me, follow the way I do things. But then I would get like, I would get self-conscious about it, which mm-hmm. made it awkward for everybody. It's like either lead or don't, you know, basically.
Right. You don't have to pretend to be a leader if you're actually leading. Like,
right.
Sort of like you're doing the thing.
And you also don't have to apologize for it.
Right.
Like, people will either follow you or they won't.
Right.
And that's, and it's fine. And if they're following you, it's fine. It's their choice.
Right.
And so you don't have to like be weird about being somebody's leader.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so I was able to just sort of like tap into my real leadership potential. And
you got some of that from being a coach, right? Some like back in the day.
Well, I coached after.
Oh, after all that. Okay.
Yeah, so like I didn't end up coaching basketball. I coached junior high basketball. And volleyball, and it was like 2000, yeah, a couple years after.
Okay, cool.
Landmark. But yeah, Landmark was huge. That was like a massive step for me. But even after that, I was still like shoplifting, still having a hard time. One big moment for me was I got caught shoplifting. I was like simultaneously, during the day, I was going into elementary school classrooms and teaching art classes to like elementary school kids. And then I'd get out of class, and then like I wasn't really getting paid for that, but it was work I really wanted to do. And then I'd go to Walmart and like steal video games and sell them, you know, try mm-hmm. to sell them. And I went to Walmart and got caught. And I was talking to the officer who ended up arresting me, and I was telling him about what it was I wanted to do in my life. And it was like, I want to, you know, talk about Meow Wolf. And I talked about like working with kids and sort of using art as a way for people to transform their lives. And I remember the cop just like broke down crying. He was like, I don't want to arrest you. And he ended up like calling his sergeant, and like on the phone with his sergeant, like he was like, I don't want to arrest this guy. Like he, you know, I, I, And the sergeant basically told him that he had to, like, you just, he's like, he broke the law and you're there. And like, they called you to arrest him. You have to arrest him. And so he actually, like, he and I, like, kind of cried together in the back offices of Walmart. And that was a big moment for me. I haven't stolen anything since then. Like, it was a real eye-opening, just like, he basically was just like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, you know, what are you doing? Don't. And I was like, you know, at this point I was like in my 30s, and he was just like, you need to just focus and you need to like get on the right track here, you know? And that was a big moment for me.
Yeah.
To have a stranger, to have a total stranger who's like meant to, is meant for punishment, is like there for the sake of like punishing people, be like sympathetic and supportive and encouraging, mm-hmm. you know, it was a big thing for me.
So you talk about that, the passion to, use art to transform people's lives. Can you talk a little bit more about, I guess, what does a transformed life mean to you? What does that look like to you? What is that, you know, just unpack that idea a little bit.
Yeah. A transformed life is, in my mind, is like, it's the ability to, it's the ability to see the world, differently than you had before, but most importantly, it's the ability to see yourself, the possibilities of yourself, in a completely different way than you had before. So like it's looking into your future, and it's seeing it's envisioning a self that is different than who you, completely different in context than the person that you are presently, mm-hmm. and then stepping into that, then becoming that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like the transformation is becoming it, is becoming that vision, but it largely is just the vision itself.
Setting the vision in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. And the reason why, like, you know, art is so important to that is like, art is the process. Creativity is the process of envisioning and then taking the steps in order to see that vision come into existence. So there's like a muscle there. Like the imagination is a muscle, and it's a muscle that can create things into the future, like can see what it wants to create in the future, and then we are the vessels that can then bring that into being.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so at the heart of it, like creativity is creation, and it gets us in touch with the creator, and the creator is the imagination. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's all that is possible within whatever it is that is imagination. And so that whole, you know, that whole line of basically like activating imagination, mm-hmm. and getting people in touch with their imagination, and then hopefully utilizing their imagination. At first it's like, okay, I mean, yeah, maybe you walk into Meow Wolf and your mind's blown by how much like creativity is around you, and you're seeing things that like you just never thought you'd see before. And that's good. It activates your imagination. And then we might put some things in there, like at the project in Santa Fe, we have like a refrigerator that you end up opening, and you walk through the refrigerator. And it's a really important moment for people, because it's like, not only is their mind activated, their imagination's activated, but now they're like literally experiencing something that is totally different than what they thought it was before. So, you know, they look at the fridge, they open it, they're like, wait, this is a whole new experience of something that I have had definition for prior. And it just starts to unlock, like, you know, hopefully the power of possibility. You know, if the fridge is different than what I thought it was, then the world can be different than I thought it was, which means I can be different than I thought I was. And it's this, like, hopefully they go into the Meow Wolf and then leave with many more possibilities and an activated right. imagination.
It triggered, or, you know, what comes up for me is, like, it's sort of like, it's a way of triggering or kindling curiosity, so that people, like, opening them up to being curious about things.
Right.
And I think that's, like, something that we have, like, in spades as kids. We're just naturally, like, wanting to get into everything and,
yeah,
like, break things and take things apart and open doors and see what's behind something. And as we age, like, we're really trained out of that in a lot of ways. We're trained out of, like, by our parents or by our jobs, our schools, social norms kind of tell us how we need to behave in most contexts. And another friend of mine, Ryan Fu in Denver, we were doing a podcast a few weeks ago, and we were talking about how, you know, his read on the movie The Matrix is that it's, like, really about these walls we build in our own minds that are limiting us. And that's, like, the real matrix is, like, you know, the way that we see the world. So for you, like, transformation, it sounds like it's an ongoing process. It's not something that, like, you're not just, like, transformed and you're done.
No, I mean, well, for myself, I mean, especially I feel like I'm in a constant state of it, and it's almost maddening in a lot of ways. Like, there, I think, is also something to be said for predictability and stagnation and consistency, you know, like, there's a balance there between the structures that we build in our mind, the predictability, and then the ongoing possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the ongoing possibility is, like, to only exist in the ongoing possibility is lacks rootedness. It's all growth. It's all blossom. It's all, like, and
it's kind of internal
extension
versus external in a way.
What do you mean?
Like, if you're just in this space of what's possible,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of like you're still in the space of imagination as opposed to building
making
that
real
thing.
Exactly. Like, making real in order to bring, whether it's a physical object or a painting or your own life or whatever, in order to bring something of possibility into existence, it needs structure, consistency, predictability, framework. And, you know, so, like, you know, I do think that I think it's cyclical, and I think it's spirally, you know, of mm-hmm. transformation, of the transformational process.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen a lot of people who are, like, I've seen both sides. I've seen people who have transformed once and then are, like, get stuck again and don't realize that, like, they can go through that cycle, that cycle is a cycle,
mm-hmm.
and resisting that cycle is what's causing issues in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've also seen people who are, like, just rapidly transforming all the time, or, like, in possibility all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't get anything rooted. They can't bring anything into existence, and they're out of touch of in reality, you know?
Right.
And so it's, like, kind of the, there's a balance there.
Totally. So another question that I have for you is, it occurred to me that, like, sometimes what we're most proud of isn't necessarily our most public accomplishment. And so I wanted to ask you, kind of, what are you most proud of? Maybe it's, you know, maybe it's the success of Meow Wolf, but maybe there's something deeper.
I'm most proud of my work with my friends. Like, I'm most proud of, like, my friendships that have resulted in that have been supportive. My supporting of people's transformations, you know, and my instigating of people's transformations is, like, probably what I'm most proud of, you know. Being patient with people, being committed, being patient with my friends, being committed to my friends, and, like, how to, like, I don't know. I have a friend, Arthur, who I met when he was 18, and he was basically custody of the state since he was 3 years old, and he never really had a family, and he never had And he just went from foster family to foster family, foster parents to foster parents. And like, and he was a meth addict and he was like in really bad shape. Probably had the emotional, at 18 when I met him, probably had the emotional intelligence of a 7-year-old. And, anger, like insane anger. And just like, you know, I was pinned up against the wall multiple times, like, you know, by him. I was like, my life is threatened by him. Like, you know, as his friend, as his like best friend and roommate. And I had to like stand my ground and be there for him even through those things and continue to try to provide, you know, a supportive context for his life. And, you know, he's definitely, he transformed, you mm-hmm. know, and he's like a father and manager of a restaurant and like just like going through that process with him. And then I've done that with others too, you know, like my friendship with you. And like those are things that are just like really important to me, I guess.
Totally. That's great.
Making one major impact, you know, with one person is like, you know, if you can just do that in your life.
Right, and then the hope is that if you make a positive impact in someone's life, that they will then be able to take that and keep pushing that ball. You know, it's like if every totally. Single person on Earth positively impacts one other person, we've just like hit everybody. You know, right. So it doesn't take much, I think. And that's one of the things like I really want to hope to inspire out of like the conversations I have on this podcast is like how it actually like really little things that we do. You know, in terms of the way we impact our friends, our communities, our coworkers, it's like we have so much power. You know, we don't need to have 30,000 followers on Instagram to be true influencers. We can influence people because that's the nature of being a social being. Like, you know,
right.
Humans are sort of hardwired to learn from each other, even without words. Just like the way that you are in a room. What, you know, how are people responding to you? And so I think that's a really, really great, you know, good for you for having that as your most proudful accomplishment. That's cool. So I have some questions that were sent to me by some Vince Cadlubeck fans that I want to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
So these aren't mine, but I think that some of them are good questions. One of them is, what do you find most compelling or attractive in another person?
I really am attracted to people who have a, sort of like a irreverence. I have like people who are sort of, positive rebels, people who are like, you know, high energy, kind of see like the possibilities of, you know, humans, possibilities of the world, like the beauty of being alive, and kind of like, express that in some amount of like subversion to the existing systems and the purveying, you know, ways of thinking. And so, yeah, that's kind of like who I, yeah.
Cool.
Radical positivity.
Nice. I like that. I thought this question was kind of interesting because it kind of goes in line with, what we were talking about with transformation and this idea of seeing your future self. The question is, what kind of elder do you see yourself as in the future?
Oh man. I have an image of like a, you know, 60 plus year old white man. That's what I'm going to end up being.
In a surprise turn of events, I'm still a white man.
Yeah, still white man. 60, you know, year old white man who's like, there's sort of a calm, a calm commitment to brilliance, you know, and a nonchalant, like a nonchalant way about myself that is like also kind of immediately impactful. It's also kind of like the, you know, it's like the 50 or 60 year old man that I'm attracted to, just sort of like, and that's, you know, actually, like, there's a lot of people in going through this process with Meow Wolf of fundraising. There's a lot of people in the world of, like, kind of like capital, like private equity that I've met that are very experienced, have gone through thousands of companies, have, like, and the good ones, the ones that have a real, like, core meaning to why they do what they do, the ones who aren't just thinking about the bottom line, there's just like this incredible integrity and experience and awareness. It's really like a connectivity to how to make things happen in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But it's done so in like such like a calm and supportive way, you know? And that's kind of how I want to model myself, you know?
Cool. Yeah, well, that kind of makes me think of something that's been on my mind lately is, like, there's this tension, I think, for a lot of people that almost becomes, like, a reflex, like a neurological reflex, where it's, like, if they're thinking about anyone or anything that has to do with power, money, development, things like that, like finance, there can be a very reflexive kind of, you know, like, oh, that's, those guys are bad guys. What they're doing is like, you know, I guess there's a justified cynicism to it because, like, we live in a world with such gross income inequalities and things like that. But I think what I've also found as a person who's come from, you know, a poor upbringing. My mom was a librarian. We were living at home with her parents. Yeah. Like, she was a single woman at 22 or whatever when she had me. And so like coming out of a background that also had a lot of poverty and a lot of struggle in it. I've also come to appreciate and understand the value of, when capital is working well, when business is doing things that are good, when it actually is being used for a creative force. And it actually impacts even the people who are, like, reflexively against it are benefiting from it in all sorts of ways in their lives. They're driving cars, they're living in homes, they're, you know. Sure. So I'm wondering, what do you have any, like, what would you say to someone, you know, to try to kind of maybe add a little more nuance to that stance of, like, oh, it's big business or it's private equity, it has nothing to do with me, and it's, like, you know.
I mean, honestly, I would say, like, you know, like step into reality, you know, get out of the tunnel vision, and, you know, the binary thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is good. Nothing is all good. Nothing is all bad. And it's just not black and white. And so, like, at the core, your binary thinking, your brain's addiction to having definition, having like certainty and definition, is at the root of the issues here. We have such a difficulty with living in ambiguity and gradient and nuance. We just want to know that this is good and this is bad, this is right and this is wrong, and it you know, it is that's the matrix that, you know, Ryan is talking about, that those are the walls that we live in, those are the definitions that we create for ourselves because we're probably afraid of dying, because we fear the unknown, we fear the ambiguous. And so that's at the heart of like, capitalism is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Capital is bad. Money is bad. Like, that's like, no, at the heart of that, you're just going to that because it's like, you know, it's the easiest thing for you to do and it's the safest place to go to. But if you step back out of it, you'll see that, like, we live longer than we ever have before. We cure diseases. We communicate like insanely more than we used to communicate.
More
we
of the world has drinking water. Yeah.
More drinking water. We have so much more knowledge share in the world than we ever have. Like absurd amounts. Access to food is like down the street for almost everybody in, you know, and it's like, and I would say that like, what we do with capital is we say, what a lot of people do is they say capitalism is bad, rather than thinking like, how can we improve it?
Well, how can we harness it for a different vision? Because that's one of the things I think it's super exciting about what Meow Wolf did is like, it was a bunch of kids with basically no resources that had a really big idea.
Right.
And then were able to attract capital to it. And then it turned into a commercial success because of that. And so like, that's one of the things that I would hope people get from the story is like, when you're feeling like an outsider who's cut off from this entire system, really the thing that's missing is a grand enough vision that can, you know, attract some kind of investment or do something that like actually has legs to take off, you know?
Now I would say that continue demanding more of your capitalism. Like, absolutely, keep demanding more of it. That should never stop.
Right.
Like, you should always want your participation in capitalism to, and your participation in the system to be one that is, is continually evolving towards the better, the more supportive, the more, you know,
bringing up equal. The bottom end. Yeah.
I think like bringing up the bottom is a lot better of, they're like bringing up, if we're looking at it from like top to bottom socioeconomic scales, focusing on uplifting that bottom and getting that as high as we can, rather than focusing on taking down the top. Now, like at some point, I think that like, yes, that in order to have that equity, the top needs to kind of come down, but don't focus on like taking down the top, focus on like bringing up the bottom. You know, because that's really where that's where the need is, you know. But like, yeah, you know, it's and demand more of the products you buy. Demand more of the money you spend. Like, don't spend on brands that like are shitty. You just stand behind that. And if you're gonna start a business, be a good business.
Right.
You know, like, and that's something with Meow Wolf. It's like, you know, there's no difference between like who we are as a business and our social impact. Like, our business is our social impact. It's not just like some little bucket on the side, you know? And so there is definitely a lot that people can do within this like capital structure. And I don't think giving up on it entirely or trying to destroy it entirely is like the right way to go.
Yeah. I think like what you're saying about, having a new, more nuanced view of the world is a big part of it. Like, I think that when we use words like capitalism, it's like a real shorthand way of saying a whole bunch of stuff. And there, it's not like capitalism is a thing that actually exists. It's actually a bunch of individual humans and a bunch of individual policies and rules. But if you actually unpack, like, you know, our economic system, it's not pure capitalism. There's all kinds of subsidies and socialist aspects of it. And it's a gradient too. It's like, So it's important to remember that it's not just like, it's not even something you just go smash capitalism or the same with socialism. It's that we need to actually just think about the things with a little bit more depth. Since finding success with Meow Wolf, do you feel that you've fulfilled your life's purpose, or is this just the beginning? And what more would you like to do in order to get that kind of fulfillment or satisfaction?
Yeah, it's tough. Like, I'm fulfilled, I'm satisfied. I don't know if I'm satisfied because of Meow Wolf's success. I think I'm satisfied because of the many brilliant times that I've had with friends and like loved ones. And it's like that to me is where my satisfaction has come from, is like I've touched the divine, with both family and friends, and So that's settling for me. That's like satisfying. With that said, I have more to do in the world. You know, and I think that like, it sounds crazy, but I ultimately want to like be part of humans' transition from physical reality into imagination, like where I see there being like a full-on paradigm shift of how we perceive reality, our world, the world around us. And I want to help be one of the instigators that gets people through that paradigm shift and fully into an imaginative existence. I don't know if that can be done in the next 60 years of my life, but 60 years is a long time.
Totally, that's great. Cool. So one of the questions I've been asking everybody I interview is kind of if they could implant one idea or practice and have that spread to every human on the planet, just kind of like virally spread one idea or thing that people would do, what would you want that to be for you?
I think, I mean, like, love is, like, the easy one. Just, like, I want love to be spread virally, you know? But that's almost, like, it's too, I don't know, there's something too easy about that. I think, like, more nuanced, I think that, like, tolerance is probably the thing. Just, like, when you feel like you're up against the other and you're being intolerant of the other, to like stop and give space to the other. And that's for both sides. That's for like the people who are not tolerant of, you know, gay people. And it's also for people who are not tolerant of Trump supporters. It's like, recognize the other as part of our collective being, our existence together, and have space for them and have tolerance and find communion in that. And so it's just like, slow yourself down and don't let like these instinctive defined walls exist without, you know, just exist just like out of instinct. Like, stop that from happening and expand your walls, create space for others, and yeah,
that's great.
Carry tolerance.
That's really great. One final question. Do you have any words of advice or wisdom for someone who maybe has a really wild idea, really big vision, and they're just at the very beginning stages of that and kind of doesn't, you know, just is sort of trying to figure out, am I even capable of doing this sort of situation?
Yeah. I mean, I talk about it often as like there's four distinct phases in creating something. And they overlap. There's sort of like overlapping arcs, and so when you kind of overlap arcs, they kind of like have a moment where as one is ending, one's beginning type of thing. But the first phase is vision. The second phase is expressing that vision, which is oftentimes expressing the vision for the sake of resources, which is oftentimes fundraising. And then the third phase is using those resources to create, which is oftentimes hiring people. And then the fourth phase is creating. And then you complete it at the end. So it's vision. So in my mind, like from a business perspective, it's vision first, fundraising second, capacity third, and then completion fourth. And oftentimes, what happens is that we don't let that arc of visioning complete because we are too worried about the next phases. So it's like, we don't let ourselves actually come up with a vision because we're worried about where's the money going to come from for the vision, or we start worrying about who's going to do the thing that I'm envisioning. Right. So we just like stop ourselves in mid visioning because we're worried about the next steps. And it's like, don't worry about those next steps. Just envision what it is and keep doing that. And that means like, it doesn't mean just like sit back and daydream and like have your mind, you know, kind of going. It means like writing that shit down, like putting a budget to it, like imagining what it looks like with, you know, how many dollars are coming in and out, imagining what it looks like from a marketing perspective. Like that's all part of the vision process. You know, envision your idea to its fullest, like as like basically envision it completed. What does it look like completed? And then once that vision is locked in, now go and fundraise. You know, and then once the money comes in, now worry about who's going to go and complete the vision with you. It makes it a lot easier to get capacity after you have the money, and it makes it a lot easier to get the money after you've completed the vision. And so just those are the steps. You know, it's like funny how basic that sounds, but like people compromise themselves all the time. Like
getting those out of order and
getting those out of order. Really, and it really is that they compromise the vision because they're worried about the funding of the vision and they're worried about the who's going to do the thing. It's like I envision a giant caterpillar, like, you know, crawling across the landscape off of I-25, this like robotic caterpillar. And you're like, that's a really cool vision. But like, you don't actually keep going because you're like, who the fuck's going to make a giant robotic caterpillar? Like, I don't know how to make one of those. Therefore, like, I'm going to stop envisioning this because I don't know who's going to make it and I can't make it. But like, the truth is, like, if you have like a really awesome vision of a giant robotic caterpillar crawling across the landscape off of I-25, like, you could probably find somebody to fund it, and then you can probably find somebody to make it. You just have to, like...
Well, I hope that somebody listening to this podcast ends up doing that, because that would be pretty radical to see. Driving down to Albuquerque, I was like, oh, it's the giant robotic caterpillar.
Totally.
Thanks, Vince.
Well, and if you're anyone from the state of New Mexico listening, like, just imagine how much tourism we would get if people knew that there was a giant robotic caterpillar crawling across the landscape.
Or even better, we were the state that was filled with such giant robotic, you know, art projects.
Yeah, totally, exactly.
Like Cloudcroft had a, you know, mechanical dragon.
Right, exactly.
Just a hint, New Mexico tourism. Right. And M. True.
Right.
Well, cool. Thanks so much for your time. I know we've got another meeting. It's been really a pleasure talking to you. And
thanks, Damien. I
will see you soon.
Cool.
That's it for this week's installment of The Created Life. Be sure to tune in next week for a dynamic discussion with Michael Davis, a 22-year-old Navy veteran and CEO of cybersecurity firm Merrick Security Solutions. Wishing you peace and prosperity in the coming week, this is Damien Taggart, signing off.